You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Troll on in. But by the way, Big Brother is a-watching you. We're going to talk about that a little bit as it applies to one part of the fishery. And how it's about time that some really cool stuff is happening in electronic monitoring. And one of the things, and this is part two of a two-part get-together we're having with Eric Kingma. Eric is in international fisheries and in the actually enforcement part of this for the council. And it's pretty interesting the way things have changed because, Eric, I was saying the other day I was on a POP talking with Sean and Jimmy and being able to watch on a monitor where their boats were. Mm-hmm. And this is really, really something. I don't think our audience really knows how much is known about not just this fleet, but just fishing in general and where we can see where folks are fishing.
Yeah, certainly the monitoring of fishing vessels, I'm talking bigger vessels right now, longline vessels, purse seine vessels, is advanced to a degree where we know where these vessels are at all times.
Yeah.
So ever since the early 90s, really the Western Pacific Council pioneered the use of what's called vessel monitoring systems,
mm-hmm.
VMS units that are satellite-based tracking devices. They use GPS and they communicate with satellites. Really, the technology was first utilized for trucking businesses, mm-hmm. I think in Europe or Great Britain, to know where these truckers are going, where they're delivering, and maybe they're going holo-holo sometime and not delivering on schedule.
Well, not only that, but I mean, even if you take it here in industry, I know a guy in the service business that had about 20 vehicles, and he started tracking them and finding out that some of his guys were having, you know, two-hour gaps in their vehicle being on the road
and
long lunches, and some of them was parked in front of a cocktail bar, and he changed all of that stuff.
That's right. Yeah. So in the early 90s, the Hawaii Longline vessels were required to use these VMS devices, and principally it was for spatial management area compliance and monitoring. The Northwestern Hawaiian Islands Protected Species Zone, 0 to 50 prohibited longline fishing within that area, and then the main Hawaiian Island longline closure, early mid-90s, which prohibited longline vessels from 50 miles generally. So those used to monitor the fleet and potentially know if they're, you know, they're incursions into those zones and if they're fishing, because you can have a signature. You can tell by the VMS signal if they're fishing or not.
I was going to say, is there a way to tell?
Well, there's
is the boat just rolling through or is it fishing?
There's a good signature. There's algorithms and stuff involved now that you can kind of tell. But it is also, to prosecute, it's helpful if you have actual visual pictures. Mm. But now, currently, you can prosecute a case, which is VMS.
Yeah. But by the way, my friends, we are this fleet, as you know, and we've talked about this a lot, the Hawaii Longline Vessel Fleet, which is about, depending on how many boats are working on any given day, but we're looking between somewhere between, say, 125, 145, whatever, somewhere in that area.
Sure.
The interesting thing is that a lot of these procedures that have been done on these guys have been models to be used in other places. We talk about gear and everything. We talk about that. But let's talk about the thing that we discuss often, Eric, and that is fish don't know what grid they're in.
Yeah.
And if I'm a fisherman and I'm chasing the signs and I'm moving, it's incumbent upon me to know if all of a sudden I've moved into waters where I'm not supposed to be fishing.
That's right. So it is incumbent upon the captain, the navigator, to know where they're at, especially with all these closed areas out there. Now we've got monuments. You know, 2/3 of the Hawaiian archipelago EEZ is closed to the longline.
Yeah.
Actually, even more now because the southern area, southern exclusion zone, because of false killer whale interactions, is closed. So there's only 17% of the EEZ around the Hawaiian archipelago right now open.
That's open at all.
That's open.
You know, I got to tell you something, and a friend of mine said this, and I kind of get it. And it's talking about, okay, they're angry because sometimes they'll be talking about the longline boats and where they're fishing, and they'll show a coral reef. Or they'll show, you know, 100 feet of water with these boats. And they just don't understand that that's not part of the longline fishery anyway.
No. And it hasn't been since the early 90s, really, until, you know,
the fish they're
the
trying
council.
To catch aren't even in that water.
Right. You know, now the fleet fishes basically 1,000 nautical miles in a circle from Honolulu Harbor.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are depths out on the high seas. even beyond, 30, 40 miles from here, depths are reaching 10,000 feet, yeah. 15,000 feet. They're fishing in the upper water column down to about 1,000 feet.
Yeah, and therein lies. Now, there's another thing. We're going to get into the monitoring. But one of the other things is, let's talk about for a minute, the swordfish fleet. Because the swordfish fleet, every single trip is monitored. And the regular longline fleet, I mean, it's at random, but they
20%.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The shallow set for swordfish is 100% observer. So every time a vessel declares, I'm going to go fish for swordfish,
right?
A NOAA observer has to get on board and go with them. So they have to call like 3 days before and say, we're planning this trip. And then the NOAA observer office, NIMS observer office, finds an observer and places them. Yeah. But in order to place that observer, they run through a big checklist. You got to have the safety certification. You got to have everything checked off.
You can't put this observer in harm's way.
Right.
Yeah.
So in order to leave the harbor, you got to make sure all the boxes are checked.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 100% in the swordfish. And then in the deep set for Big Eye and others, it's 20% observer coverage. And that has been the highest level of longline tuna observer coverage anywhere in the Pacific for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Hawaii longline fishery has led the way in terms of being monitored to really no other degree being replicated by any other fleets, like the Asian fleets, the Japanese, mm-hmm. Taiwanese, Korean, Chinese fleets. Those are all monitored with observer less than 5%. Mm-hmm. So what they're moving to now is, electronic monitoring. And that's onboard camera systems. So potentially replacing a human observer with an onboard camera system.
Okay, here's where I have some questions. Obviously, and we're taking a look at, say, this new HART project, the rail. It's going to be driverless. And I guess there's really a lot of stuff that electronically and technically we have at our fingertips today. Are you relatively certain that the equipment can't be tampered with? In other words, if you set it up on this boat, and this boat's going to go 600 miles away and fish, you know what this boat's doing the whole time.
Yeah, so with the onboard camera systems, there are sensors tuned in to their hydraulics, to their different types of equipment on the boat. So it knows, it'll start the camera when the hydraulic reel goes.
Mm-hmm.
So, nothing's really ultimately never tamper-proof, but, if it's a repeat offender or an occurring occurrence, the NIMS enforcement, the National Fisheries Service, U.S. Coast Guard, they will find out.
Of course.
They're not going to be able to go too much longer without it. So this is a new frontier in fisheries monitoring. It's called electronic monitoring or onboard video camera systems. We've been testing it in the Hawaii fleet since 2010. We're not ready for full implementation yet. There's a lot to build up and how you store the video, how much times you audit the video, you review it, at what speed, what the objective is. So there's a lot to develop.
But let's say that all of these things fall into place and it becomes something that becomes commonplace that's used on every trip or whatever, right? I'm going to guess that there are a tremendous number of owners and captains and maybe even crew members that are in favor of this because they know if they go out and work hard, they're going to make a good living. If they catch the fish, they're going to work hard. But they want to think that everybody's following the same playbook.
That's right. So it does, even or level the playing field because everyone's being watched. So there are some benefits to it. There's a video that you can use to show that you were in compliance, if there was a question. Whereas if the human observer is on board, it's basically his word versus yours.
Yeah.
So there's benefits there. For captains, there's cameras looking out on the decks, on the rail, and the captain can stay in the wheelhouse dry and warm and watch the whole operation.
But what about the observers themselves that are now? Are they also using recording devices? It's not they don't just write stuff in a notebook, do they?
No, now they're starting to use electronic logbooks. Mm-hmm. We're also submitting data real-time, onboard daily. And that's also
really
what's
cool.
happening,
let's,
too.
Let's talk about that a little bit, too, because in addition to the monitoring, there's also a way to mandate reporting.
Yep.
And that equipment. And you must be fascinated, as I am, that it can work over such long expanses of ocean and everything and still be connected. And some of it is satellite and some of it's not.
Yeah. So right now we are looking at actually the council at its next meeting here in a couple weeks in the Marianas. will be considering for the first time mandatory electronic reporting for the Hawaii Longline fleet. So that would be a daily transmission of logbook data sent via satellite through the VMS unit, and that would go to the National Marine Fisheries Service. And hoping as we develop the system that information will also go to the vessel owner.
Okay, now if you put on your enforcement hat for a minute, I'm imagining being able to monitor and then enforce rules because of this technology will be a lot more achievable, a lot maybe even easier.
Yeah, so the electronic logbook supports more on the monitoring side of quotas, and also it's just way more efficient, reduces maybe some errors in writing down numbers of fish and where you were fishing, the GPS location, etc. The onboard camera systems are really being utilized in a lot of fisheries globally now for more compliance reasons, not necessarily just for basic monitoring. You still need human observers to do some monitoring, like sampling a fish, sampling the bycatch that's not brought back. So there is still a need for human observers. Right now, these onboard camera systems in a lot of places are being thought as to supplement human observer programs, but in some places, they are totally replacing them as well.
Yeah, interestingly enough to me, and this is, I've talked to a lot of observers, sometimes they don't even have that much advance notice themselves. If they're on the list and their name comes up, they might get a call and say, hey, you're going tomorrow.
You know? Yeah, I give those guys credit. Yeah, me too. It's not an easy job. Yeah. You know, they get thrown on onto someone's workplace. It's a boat. It's tight quarters. Not always the cleanest.
You may or may not have the language ability to speak.
And that's what another benefit of some of these onboard camera systems are, too, is for the crew, you don't have someone who's not part of their group, that just comes in and throws off dynamics. Humans throw off dynamics all the time. So,
well, I can tell you, though, the guys and gals that I've spoken with are pretty driven, and this is a step in their career. I mean, none of them want to be a longline fleet observer forever, but they realize that this is a resume builder and a good one.
Yeah, I know a lot of former observers who are now involved in policy and regulation and management, and even into the industry as well.
And having that experience must be very key importance to them.
Yeah, and it's on the water experience, so it's invaluable.
Okay, so that being said, this is not in any way an effort to replace these folks. If anything, it's going to create opportunities at the home end, to process all of this stuff.
Yeah, but someone's got to review the data as well.
I was going to say, let's take a look at it. But here is, everybody always asks me when after we've spoken, because we talk about enforcement, does this make it, I don't want to say easier, but more of a slam dunk when you have to do enforcement, when you have that sort of record or evidence to present to the powers that be and the fishermen and the captain?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there is a video record that would be available to enforcement agencies if they were developing a case, as opposed to a written record, and then you're going off of interviews with the observer, interviews with the crew and captain. So I think there are potential benefits for enforcement and compliance with electronic monitoring. But that said, it's not cheap. It requires a lot of funding and a lot of back-end, development of a database that can store a lot of this video. Because right now, the video is not transferred at sea, the data. Mm-hmm. That's very expensive. Although there's quite a bit of gains in that field right now. The technology is rapidly advancing to do that at sea. Mm-hmm.
You're talking about being able to upload a 13-hour
video. That's happening. Yeah, yeah. It's getting better and better every day. But right now with these camera systems, when the vessel returns, the hard drive is extracted and then provided to whoever's going to review the data. So you're still relying on someone watching a screen for an event that happened maybe 3 weeks ago or something.
Okay, now I can't understand where a boat owner, a fleet owner, or a captain would resent something being forced upon them if everybody else wasn't doing it. So when you say, to me this smacks of expense, and I wonder, number one, where would the funding be coming from, and who would be it responsible to maintain the equipment, because the captain on the boat has no clue.
Yeah, so in Hawaii, really the observer program on these longline vessels, the main objective is to document and understand and record protected species interactions. So that's sea turtles, marine mammals, birds, and now some sharks are protected under the ESA. So that's really the objective of the observer program. It also collects, you know, life or bio samples of fish and for life history studies and stuff like that. Record some of the bycatch that is discarded, like lancet fish and snake mackerel. But we know that. I mean, that it's not really changing that much. So really it's about protected species management. And, you know, that is a that's the objective. In other parts of the world, other parts of the country, West Coast, for example, they're using electronic monitoring for monitoring bycatch and quota of stocks like rockfish.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's quota management, not necessarily protected species. Yeah. So currently the National Marine Fisheries Service, that on a national level, has developed a policy directive that indicates that observer programs and electronic monitoring programs with the main objective for protected species monitoring will be funded by the federal government.
Okay. Now, in case you're just joining us, Eric Kingma at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, involved in the international fishery and the treaties and the interaction between all of the different stakeholders, particularly in this huge, you know, our district. And what's coming up, we're talking about the electric monitoring today and everything else, and I'm just guessing that we've been able to do some incredibly interesting things in stock assessments with technology. And it seems to me that this thing's kicking it up to the next level. But when you start talking about satellites and cameras and expensive devices, somebody at the other end of it's going to have to say, all right, where's the money coming from? You started to say what pays for it before.
Yeah.
And I know part of it. And I want to make sure that people that are listening that go down to the fish market and buy fish don't think that they're paying for part of it, but in some respects they are.
Yeah, they are. It is taxpayer money that is going towards the monitoring of the fleet. And, you know, when we're talking about endangered species that are endangered not because of this fishery, but because of a wide variety of cumulative impacts, and it's the law, the Endangered Species Act, it's a federal law, there's a nexus there to support it with federal dollars.
You know, I was interesting. I was almost going to say that today's program could have wrapped up in all about this big this hurricane and what exactly has happened with Johnson Island and with some of the other things, where you've had some scientists that are saying, uh-oh, are we going to even be alive tomorrow? People don't understand what a thin thread there is out there.
Yeah, and technology is ever being used in stock assessments and monitoring fisheries. Now, VMS, back a decade ago, was principally for enforcement and compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's used to monitor vessel position with respect to oceanographic conditions and catch rates and those types of things in stock assessment. In the purse seine fishery in the equatorial Pacific, you know, one of these large purse seiners will deploy 350 fads a year.
Mm-hmm.
They're all equipped
Okay, gang, let's back up a minute. And 350 fads a year. FAD is a fish aggregation device.
Yeah.
We have a couple double handfuls of them here in Hawaii.
Yeah, the ones we have in Hawaii are anchored.
Right.
The ones the purse seiners are throwing over are drifting fads.
Yep.
So there's usually like a what they call a raft, maybe a 6x5.
Looks like a little yellow boat.
Yeah. or it's bamboo tied together with line and netting material. But then it'll have an appendage that goes down about 150 feet or so.
Yeah.
So of net, webbing, and stuff like that. Mm.
Now what happens is this attracts little things, right?
Yeah, it attracts the bait fish, which attract the bigger fish.
Right. So it in fact becomes a food station.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of these drifting fads now are equipped with satellite-based beacons.
Unbelievable.
And they're all equipped with echo sounders.
And this is so the owners can go find them to go fish. Yeah.
So you can be in a office in Seattle and have a fleet of 10 purse seiners and have, you know, a couple thousand fads being watched, and you know the biomass under those fads.
Okay, let's explain that to people. Okay, let's say that we've got my boat. We have 100 of these things. And aren't they going to actually tell the skipper where you're going to go fishing? Because you're looking at these 100 deals. Maybe 20 of them are within, say, 100 miles of where you are. Mm-hmm. All right? And so which is the one they're going to go to? Well, this one's got the big biomass. Let's
right.
go there.
So that's where, you know, if they're working in a group or they're individuals, if it's an individual captain on his own, doesn't have that type of support, he'll have his screen in the wheelhouse, and he'll be able to see which one has the most biomass. And
wow.
If it's a group of vessels and there's sort of a central person in some office somewhere directing those fleets,
they'll say,
go over here, go steam 100 miles, and because it's going to be a much bigger catch. But now the technology is advancing where they'll recognize species ID too. Mm-hmm. Now it's sort of just biomass.
I was
going to
ask you about that. Yeah. Let's make sure that people understand. When you say biomass, that simply means there's a lot of stuff there. And it may not be the stuff you want to catch. There's just a lot of something going on there.
Right.
But I would imagine as the equipment gets more sophisticated and the skipper or the person monitoring it, they will be able to tell what species that is and what their size is.
Yeah, right now the good skippers that are using these things, they're familiar with them, they know they know the biomass, and they know pretty much the species based on their experience and the signature that is being shown on the screen. And it is rapidly advancing as well. And, you know, about 10 years ago, none of these fads were equipped with echo sensors.
Now they all are. Now they all got them.
And it's a total game changer.
You know, those of you that watch Wicked Tuna, you'll quite often hear, it's part of the repartee, just where the skipper is like leaning back and resting or almost snoozing, and then you hear this bing, bing. We're marking them. Isn't that, in some respects, exactly what we're talking about? They're marking the fish.
That's right.
Yeah.
They'll see them on screen.
Yeah.
And with respect to the purse seine fleet, they got 100 of these things out.
Yeah.
And at one time, they might deploy 350 a year. At any one time, they're monitoring maybe 200 or so.
You know, is there like a range in cost about what they cost? Because I remember talking to my good friend at Oceantronics, Fritz, years ago.
Yeah, Fritz.
About this. And talking about some of the things that some of the advanced fishermen were doing to take advantage of technology then, which was, in comparison, pretty primitive to what we got now.
Yeah.
It's extremely expensive.
One of these beacons, it's about $1,500.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are disposable. In the eyes of the person.
Yeah.
And so are these fads. So a lot of these fads will drift out of the area of a seiner.
And that's it.
They'll drift off. They'll end up on a beach. About a quarter of them end up on a beach.
Yeah.
Or they just don't report anymore, and they're just drifting. And we get them here sometimes in Hawaii.
I'm wondering how they could chew up a boat. They're not that. Some of them are pretty big.
Yeah. I mean, if you prop some netting in that, you're going to feel it for sure.
So, and this is why you don't want to have autopilot on and everybody be sleeping all the time. But that's neither here nor there. But the interesting thing is how you can not only identify what technology is available, but use it and then enforce it. So let's talk about all of this information that's being processed, say off a purse seiner, where they're not supposed to be in certain places.
Mm-hmm.
We can tell when they are.
You can tell where they are. You can
and what
also,
they're catching.
And what they're catching. And now, with this electronic monitoring onboard camera systems, really the frontier is machine learning, artificial intelligence to support fisheries monitoring and fish ID. So you run a fish through a field of view of the camera, like on a belt or whatever, and the camera and its associated computer will recognize the species and the weight, the length, all that kind of stuff.
You know, I got a friend, Bob, who's a regular listener to this show. And Bob, if you're out there today, particularly with your boys, he's got two very Nielli, very inquisitive kids. One's 12 and one's 13. And this is the question that came up. And I'm glad I remembered Bob and his kids. Nikki, I think, and Tom are the kids. Anyway, one says, you know, we're in school, we learn that the population of the world is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's lots and lots of billions of people on the planet. And we keep growing, it seems. And their question really is sort of related to, what about fish? Are fish increasing in numbers? And it would seem unlikely. So that means that we have to know when to eat certain fish and when not to eat certain fish. Isn't that pretty bright for young kids to come up with?
It's amazing. Yeah. And that is one of the biggest issues facing fisheries management now is a increasing global population. I think right now we're like 7.3 billion. In 30 years, the world's population is supposed to be nearly 10 billion.
Yep. That's exponential growth.
Right. Yeah. And we are, most fisheries are exploited. Some are fully exploited globally. Some are overfished. Those overfished stocks are rebuilding in many cases. And so those populations are increasing. So when you have an overfished stock and you have the right management controls where you restrict fishing, those stocks will rebuild. So you do get more fish. For those fisheries and stocks that are experiencing quite a bit of exploitation, we'll take tropical tunas, for example, but still considered healthy, you're not going to get more biomass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? Now, but here's the thing. This fuels the fire about growing fish, about farming fish. And I know that the jury is still out in many cases, but there's no question that it may not be something that you might want to think of today, but it down the road may be of something that you have to think of, unless we can find other land-based food sources that will give us the protein and the value that seafood does.
Yeah, and that's another big issue facing us in fisheries is the role of aquaculture and how that will work with marine capture fisheries.
I'll tell you why, Eric, what this kid said, this kid Tom said, you know, he said, sometimes you got to feed fish that you're growing fish. And so it doesn't make any sense, you know, and unless the fish that you're producing is more valuable than the fish that you're feeding them with. And that's the case, isn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes it might take 10 pounds of fish meal to produce 1 pound
of this desirable fish.
There's issues there for sure. But a lot of attention is being paid towards aquaculture and even offshore marine aquaculture. And I mean, it is certainly the future.
Yeah.
And there's some argument that could be made that all these fads being deployed in the purse seine fishery is almost like ranching.
It is in many respects. Let's say that you connected them all together.
Yeah.
You would have a floating wall of fads that could be 10 miles long.
Right. Yeah, and it's just how you envision the fence, basically. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But no doubt marine offshore aquaculture takes a lot of capital investment.
Mm.
So to start up a business like that, you need millions of dollars to get started, say offshore of Hawaii. It's just, it's not that practical and feasible given the cost. So plus you dump all this money and you have to wait 2 or 3 years before you get your first.
Yeah. It's like farming, waiting for that first apple to grow or something. Right.
So it's difficult in that respect, but certainly, you know, there are countries like China who are supplying a lot of seafood globally. And most of it is farm raised. Mm-hmm. Tilapia, for example. There are, I think, like over 250,000 tons of tilapia imported into the United States a year at like a couple billion dollars from China. So it's major, major farm raised fish.
There would be, however, in the sort of in the health food business and in the natural markets and all of this stuff, this pushback about farm raised fish. And it, for instance, quite often salmon get counted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you take a salmon that's farm raised without coloring it, it doesn't look like a salmon. Is it still a salmon? Well, maybe it is an altered salmon. Is it safe and good to eat? That comes up a lot, you know. So I think the jury is still out, but everybody's leaning that way.
I agree with you. Jury's still out. And if we're going to feed in a rapidly increasing global human population, and seafood being a healthy diet choice, it's got to be figured out. What does that mean for marine capture fisheries, for wild fish stocks?
Exactly.
Well, you know, with scarce resources comes higher prices, and certainly there will be always an interest to catch fish if they're going to get a return out of it.
You bet.
And so we don't think wild capture fisheries are going to go away. The artisanal fisheries will remain, and that's why local governments, counties have to be akamai with their local fisheries, because it is important. But in more industrial fisheries, certainly you're going to get more concentration, more conglomerates, more corporations involved for the whole chain, from vessels to supply, all the way to the retail.
And that's why, gang, some of this you can capture at wpcouncil.org, because these things come up. And all of the things that Eric Kingman and I have been talking about today are things that come up at meetings. And some of these meetings are here in Hawaii, and some of them are all over the place. You're just about to go traipsing off down way south. What's going on there?
Yeah, we're about to go on a week and a half long trip to the Marianas, where is part of the council's jurisdiction. So that's Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands. The Northern Mariana Islands has an extensive archipelago. Yeah, it's about 500 miles long and a whole western seamount chain, a bunch of volcanic islands, beautiful islands. And they don't have any industrial fisheries, really. They used to support some U.S. purseine fleet, some foreign longline vessels still transship out of Guam, but there's no local fishing industry like Hawaii. Yeah. There's a lot of fisheries development potential in the Northern Mariana Islands because there's a lot of now...
Well, now there's space.
There's space.
And now there's technology and there's the Chinese investment, right?
And and with Guam, you know, it's a major tourism hub.
Yeah, yeah.
And also a major military personnel area. So there's, you know, about 200,000 people on Guam, I think.
Yeah, interestingly enough, and as we parse through this stuff, somebody always asks the question, okay, when I was in a big box the other day, I saw farm fish and caught, you know, wild caught fish, same fish, mm-hmm. same color, $3 or $4 a pound in difference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so some people say, well, is buying the cheaper one bad for your health? And I'm saying that it's probably not, but it may not be as good. So what do? Have to eat more? I mean, what's the answer here?
Well, the I think there have been some studies that some farm-raised fish do lack some of the omega.
Yeah, some of the natural ingredients.
Sort of benefits of fish. And they also have to subject to antibiotics as well and coloring. So there are some issues with farm-raised fish. But, you know, those will probably be overcome in the future.
Well, I saw a salmon that these friends of mine brought in that were farm salmon. And the meat was gray. And I almost didn't want to. I thought, this looks like it's spoiled. It tasted fine.
Yeah.
You know, now it may have been, but I'm also of a fact that say, okay, let's say that it doesn't give you enough omega-3 red that you need or whatever. Supplement yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, sometimes that can work too. And isn't, don't most of us vote every day we go to the market with our wallet?
That's right. Yeah. And you're voting every time you spend money on, you know, Hawaii fish and versus, you know, gas and other kind of stuff.
Tailpipe Bayou, we call it, right. But it's interestingly enough, and I think that what's happened here, and as we can finish up with this today, even though I know Eric well from a, you know, just a personal standpoint, even though it's not with his hat on about enforcement and international fisheries, that we pretty much do kind of all care. And one of the big things, the other big thing that nobody seems to be talking about is when you're looking at the farm stuff locally around the immediate islands, you're looking about all of this effluent and all of this stuff that comes out of it. Isn't, when you think about it feasibly, when you get out in the middle of nowhere ocean down the road, that this will be able to done on a large scale business, on a large scale basis, and maybe give us a way to think that we're not going to run out of fish.
Yeah, and I think that could be location dependent, you know, whether it's Hawaii or maybe it's other areas with less trade winds or, you know, different types of, you know, suitable siting for large-scale aquaculture, like Mexico has bluefin ranching and stuff like that. So for Hawaii, the council has been working on an amendment to allow offshore aquaculture to be permitted, to be regulated, to
be inspected, monitored, sure.
And all that. And so, you know, the council is generally supportive, but it has to make sense in terms of you can't be releasing a bunch of effluents and escapes of fish that'll injure the ecosystem, and it has to be monitored. But
I was going to say that, and the way to finish up today, Eric, is that put on your enforcement hat for a minute. When you have the tools like we talked about before, the electronic monitoring and reporting that we're going to be able to deploy, and certainly anybody that does this large-scale aqua farming is going to be expected to really monitor that thing. But then it comes down to consequences and enforcement, doesn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, it's the future is going to be automated. And then it comes down to ensuring that that automation is subject to the right monitoring and the right controls to prevent any, you know, potential environmental disasters.
Yeah, and there you go. And, you know, real quickie, when you go down to these meetings, there's going to be fishers forums down there.
Yeah.
I'd be interested when you get back to talk to some folks how those forums compare to the ones that we have here. That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, certainly.
Thanks, Eric. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Uncle Mike.
If you want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. The themikebuckshow@gmail.com. So now on behalf of POP Fishing and Marine, Life Raft and Marine Safety, and the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, go catch some, but leave some for me. See you next time.